to begin where we left off last week. And we've got Mr. Gary Buchanan over here.
I remember that name.
Okay, well, he's going to ask, he's got some questions, and then there's a couple of others that have got, one other got a question. And we'll just sit back and listen to you and Gary talk a while, and then we'll just take it up from there, okay?
Sure.
It's good to have you with us this evening.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right, thank you. Gary, just stick that on your head, and I'll push the buttons. Don, you're going to have to give us more volume out of that thing.
I got several questions, about four, I think.
Okay.
And I'll start, I think, with a fairly simple one. We'll just take each one of them individually because they're deal with different areas of this. My first question is dealing with the serpent and the serpent that bit the people. Did the serpent only bite the people that I will assume some of the people were not murmuring against God? I think it's a reasonable assumption to assume that everyone didn't murmur, but we know that some certainly did. Did it bite only the people that murmured against God? Or did it bite, was there any difference between ones that didn't murmur and ones that did murmur?
I would say on the basis of the Rashi that I quoted, that on the basis of the verses, there were two different categories of people. And there was one group of people that were bitten by other animals, as we mentioned. And apparently their sin was not as severe. And they would not die that quickly. And they only had to glance at the copper snake. Whereas the second group, it says those who were bitten by the snake, they had to stare at it intensely and to concentrate. So apparently their sin was worse, and they would die much more quickly. So on the basis of that, I'd come to the conclusion that it was selective, that the providence of God worked in a particularistic kind of a way, and that the sinners were punished by the, not only by snakes according to Rashi, but by other animals as well. And I would deduce from that that the people who had not sinned were not afflicted. Yes, continue to your next question unless you want any further questions.
That's good. My second question is do we have any other examples in the Torah where God uses some type of symbolism that the people would look for to use for healing or improving their relationship with God?
Basically, no. If, this is, as I mentioned, the Mishnah, in the Talmud of Rosh Hashanah, it drew an analogy between the analogous case to this would be the case that the Talmud mentions, the hands of Moses, which is not healing. I don't mean to say it's healing, but it plays a symbolical role in helping the Jews to improve their relationship with God, as Rashi quotes, to subordinate their hearts to their Father in heaven. But as far as using a particular device which has a symbolical significance for the sake of healing, no. As far as I know, I mean, there's none other. This is the only case that I'm aware of at the moment. Yes, continue. Hello?
He's
in case there's many questions.
He's got to push the button here so I can talk to you.
Fine.
I have to wake him up so I push the button. I'm just kidding. What theory do we have that why God would use this method only in this case, and why was this case a particular case where God would need to deal differently with the people?
That's a very good question. The uniqueness of this case, the Jews had sinned in other situations before, and the idea of being punished, there are two elements over here. The first element is that the Jews were punished by some type of a plague. In this case, it happened to be the fiery serpent. In other cases, they were punished with other types of plagues. So the idea of being punished, that God does bring a calamity upon them to bring them back to their senses, because they're just following their instincts, their emotions, and they're not stopping to think. They don't realize that they're in a state of sin, so God brings a calamity upon them. That we have in many cases. But this is unique in the sense that it was not sufficient at this point. Even when they realized that they were in a state of sin, and they appealed to Moses, and Moses prayed for them, it was not sufficient. I think the key element over here is two things, I would say. First of all, the nature of the sin, which I mentioned to you as evil talk. It consisted in terms of slander. And slander is regarded as being one of the most serious sins that a person can commit, one of the most corrupting elements in man's constitution, evil talk, slander. And it was directly against God. In other cases, in previous cases, this is not the first time the Jews have complained about the travails of the wilderness. They had complained before about the lack of food, about the lack of water, and so on and so forth. But it was always disguised. It was always veiled as a complaint against Moses or Aaron. They complained about Moses and Aaron. And Moses would answer them and mention that don't think that you're complaining about me. If you would analyze yourself, really, it's a complaint about God. You're just displacing your complaints, which are directed at God, onto Moses. But in this case, it was direct. It was a significant thing the verse says in verse 5 is the people spoke about God. So I would say that's a worsening. Here it came out in the opening. It was a direct form of evil talk about God. And the other element was that this type of a thing is very difficult to deal with, because it meant that they had reached a point where they were controlled by the instincts, by the emotions, and in a hidden type of a way. That was the whole idea of the serpent. The serpent plays a very significant role over here. And the tshuva, of course, in order to be cured, they had to repent. The Hebrew term is tshuva. But it was not enough, because here they needed a confrontation with the emotional element. Because, as I tried to mention last week, the whole essence of the snake is that it harms, the way it destroys them is because of the fact that it's hidden. So the expression, in this particular case, the expression of the instinctual element was such that it had corrupted them to the point where it needed a stronger dose, I would say. And it was, again, it was God's compassion for them that he gave them a method by which they could be saved. But it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for them just to admit that they were wrong. Because the corruption had reached that point where it was essential that they undergo a process of conversion from being controlled by certain emotions that they were not aware of. They had to face these emotions, and they also had to see how these emotions had distorted their whole way of thinking. And I think that's why, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, because I wanted to make a point that it wasn't just the fact that they were bitten by snakes, but fiery snakes, which means poisonous snakes. And the snake represents the instinctual element. The poison represents the false philosophies. So as long as they were affected by these false philosophies, they could not be saved. In the other cases, it was an emotion that had overcome them. So when an emotion overcomes them, so those people are punished, some people are killed. But then once they acknowledge it and they give up the emotion, it's one thing. But here, the sin consisted of a certain type of a mental and philosophical corruption, and that required a process of removing that corruption from their souls. And I think that was effectuated through the means of the copper snake. Next question, please.
Okay, guess my last question. In regard to the instruction God gave Moses on the serpent and to put it on a pole, would you explain maybe you might start by defining the idolatry, the image part of idolatry, and the difference between what happened here that would not make this idolatry?
Yes. In idolatry, a person is having a certain relationship with the object. He formed a certain attachment to the object. And he's projecting certain powers onto the object, and in fact, this is taking him away from God. It's because he has certain insecurities that he needs to have addressed. He feels weak. He feels insecure. And rather than, you know, reach the level where he can relate to the God of reality, he needs a physical object. Now, as soon as he needs a physical object, it means that he's not relating to the God of reality, but he's projecting. The God that he's relating to is a psychological phenomenon which he is constructing. He's constructing a God in his own image or in the image of certain parental figures, and he invests them with certain powers, and their role is to protect them from certain things that he's afraid of. So in all those cases, there's a relationship with the entity itself, and he derives a certain satisfaction in the fact that that entity is giving him a certain protection. But in this case, it was not the case at all. As Rashi points out, the entire purpose of this serpent, and of course, I would say another thing is that I don't think that a person would, if he were fashioning an idol, he would use something which was a fiery serpent, which is poisonous. I don't think it catered to that type of an imagination. The entire objective of this was to get them to confront the evil within their own nature, their own instinctual elements which had corrupted them. This is something which they didn't want to confront. In fact, if they failed, as we see, the people that were bitten by the snake, it wasn't sufficient if they would just glance at it. They had to study it and stare at it intently. And that, I suppose, is something that went against their own brain, because they knew exactly what that stood for. That stood for the element which was a barrier between them and God. And only by confronting that barrier could they remove the forces which took them away from God, and they have to subordinate their heart to their Father in heaven. So it's the exact opposite of the desire to construct an image, in which case the person is directing his worship, his act of worship towards the object. When a person directs his act of worship towards the object instead of towards God, and even if he intends, by the way, the sin of the golden calf was not a denial of the Creator, but rather was a mistake in how one is to relate to the Creator. They thought that they could relate to the Creator through a certain object, but it wasn't the objective was not to deny God. But once you're relating to the Creator through an object, then you are directing an act of worship to an object. And that is considered idolatry, because the moment you do so, you're giving in to those needs for a certain comfort that a person derives from projection, from projecting human emotions onto a deity. That's idolatry. In this case, they did not pray to the serpent at all. They rather subordinated themselves. It was a process of repentance. And as I said, if anything, there would have been a resistance. The barrier was the instinctual element, and they had to confront it and face it, which is a painful thing to do, and to work through all the emotions which separated them from God. So I think that would be a totally different thing than having an image, which would be considered idolatry. That's my answer.
Comment on that subject. If we were to look upon that incident and to in that day and it not have been what God has done, you know, let's just say the very same thing happened, but we didn't see it in this writing of Moses, wouldn't we question whether it would be idolatry or not?
I'm not quite sure. You'll have to clarify your question. I have just a vague idea of what you're getting at. If we had seen what?
Let's just say perhaps that this very type of thing, the very same thing happened, but it was not in the Torah.
I see what you're saying.
That's
a good point.
Yeah.
That was my question. That was what attracted me to the area. That's what I wanted to elucidate, because at first glance, if a person reads the story superficially, you don't have to go that far. Not only if you just saw this type of phenomenon occurring without understanding. I mean, the fact that even the way, if you read the story superficially without understanding, one could be very confused. It does appear. I agree with you that the appearance of the phenomenon itself would justifiably lead a person to that type of a conclusion. But that is not what occurred over here, and we have to study the Torah through the concepts that have been handed down to us through the Masorah, through the oral law, through the rabbis, and so forth. It has to be understood properly. And I quote to you from Rashi, who's quoting the rabbis of the Talmud. But I would agree with you. The reason why I want to elucidate it is because one should not. If one read this superficially, one could have the idea that there was certain type of magical powers inherent in this fiery serpent, and it would appear like some mystical voodoo kind of a thing. And there's no such thing in the Torah, as the Talmud makes very, very clear, that the whole salvation consisted of the fact that they had to recognize that only God can destroy, and only God can heal. And the only way that they can save themselves is through a proper relationship to God. Okay? That's how it would appear. That's how the thing would appear superficially. I can't do anything about that. But the reality is as I've described it to you. Continue, please.
All right. this is me back.
Hi, how you doing,
me? All right, me. I'm good, fine, me.
Yes.
Okay, now, I want to come at this from another standpoint that we talked about last week. Now, last week I mentioned the fact of Moses, and you explained how Moses, as the mediator for the people, how he mediated for them. Now, as you know, most of the people in B'nai Noach come from a Christian background, with the New Testament, background. Now, I want to read to you several verses in the New Testament, and I don't expect you to give an answer for these, but I want you to understand how great a problem the passage in Exodus becomes in light of 1,700 years of Christian theology. All right, in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 5, says, "For there is one mediator between God and for there is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus, or Jesus the Messiah, if you want to look at it that way." And then you turn to Hebrews chapter number 8 and verse 6. Now this is dealing with Moshe. And in verse 5 says, "Who served unto an example and shadow of heavenly things." I know this is strange language for you. "As Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle, for see, saith he, that thou makest all things according to the pattern shown thee in the mountain. And now had he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant." Now this "he" here is talking back to Jesus again, that he is the mediator of the better covenant. Then Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 15, it talks about, "For this cause he is the mediator of the New Testament." Then chapter 12 and verse number 24, we come unto Jesus, the mediator of the New Testament. Now, as I spoke with Rabbi Chait several weeks ago, we talked about this thing of revelation as Moses received the Torah pay. God said he would speak to the prophets in dreams and visions. And then we come to the Second Temple period, and we said that all this stuff stopped. But see, from a person coming from a Christian background, being taught what he is, we've got five passages of New Testament writings, Nazarene writings, that shows Jesus is superior, because now we don't have the law, we got grace, whatever that means. And then that Jesus is the mediator, and if you view him properly, he is doing the same thing for the Christian that Moses did for the Israelite. Now that's the whole argument. Do you see how that is played into the text?
I can see what you're getting at, but I think that on a superficial level, I could see one might make a case. But notice the term over here. The Torah never uses the term mediator. What I would say, I was thinking of two differences. First of all, as I understand it, the basic doctrine of the New Testament, or as Christianity interprets it, is that the people, this was mentioned last week when you raised that question, is that the people cannot have a direct relationship with God, and they can only relate to God through a mediator. So therefore, the people can only have a relationship with Jesus. And that's idolatry, as we've mentioned. Any mediator. And according to Judaism, each individual can have a direct relationship with God. I tried to explain that this does not obviate the capacity of one individual to pray for another individual. Because you have to understand the philosophy of prayer, how prayer operates, and what are the factors that can make a prayer efficacious. Now, then we're dealing with the area of under what circumstances will God answer a prayer. I tried to explain that the purpose of prayer is to elevate an individual, even if the particular is not answered. But we do believe that God listens to prayer and God does answer prayer if a person is meritorious. Now, it does happen that the merit of one person can be effective for another individual, but that's not some mystical thing. There's nothing mystical about that because it means to say that he's on the level of providence. When a person gets closer to God in terms of a true relationship to God, so he's to a greater extent under the providence of God, and God will provide him with his needs. Now, if his needs happen to be that his child should be healed, because that's important to him, so then the child will be healed. But that's not that is because that has become the need of this individual who's on a very high level. It may not be in the merit of the child, or it may not be in the merit of the other individual, but the person can pray to God directly, and he can be meritorious of God's providence in his own right. I'm just trying to explain that what we see over here is Moses is not really acting as a mediator, but Moses is praying on behalf of the people, and the prayer of a great individual can be efficacious for others. Now, the other idea of mediator, our concept of Moses as a mediator is purely with respect to, I would say, the difference between, we have a legitimate concept of a Rebbe, of having a Rebbe who's our teacher. And there are other people who have the concept of a Rebbe who's some type of a guru or in cult. You see that. And that's quite a different thing. Where the people begin to just attach themselves to the person, any cult leader, and I don't care whether he's Jewish or whatever, it doesn't make any difference to me, but you can find this even amongst the Jewish people. But if his role is that it's a certain type of a worshipful thing, they're totally taken by his charisma, by his persona, and everything that he says has special qualities, and there's no challenge, there's no questioning of him. That's not the legitimate role. The legitimate role we call Moshe, Moses Rabbeinu, our teacher. He's not Moshe, our mediator. He's our teacher. And we recognize the fact that he reached a level of intellectual and moral perfection and the highest level of prophecy that nobody else would ever reach. That enabled him to receive from God an understanding which nobody else could. But his whole purpose is to communicate that knowledge to us and to perfect us through knowledge. And Moshe can't do anything for us. We have to do everything for ourselves. And that's totally different than giving over our faith to our belief in a certain individual. If you have faith in this individual, you're saved. If you don't have faith in this individual, then you're lost. That is to the deification of an individual, and there's no perfection insofar as you're concerned. That's removal of your requirement that you're involved, that you're endowed. You have a divine soul. Each person has a divine soul. And the perfection is the same for everybody. It's insofar as he's able to raise himself to a proper relationship to God and to improve, to perfect his divine element, the soul. Everybody has that task, the smallest and the greatest. And the only thing that Moses does for us is Moses, our teacher. And so therefore, the idea of a mediator, the same term superficially, one could make a comparison, but in reality, it's two completely different things. The role, let me just sum up over here. The role of Moses essentially is our teacher. And we need him because he reaches a level of understanding that we could not reach. It doesn't, if there were never a Moses, it doesn't mean to say that we couldn't function. People reached perfection before Moses. The Noahites, even before Abraham. Abraham was on a very high level of prophecy, but even individuals before, Shem and Eber, were great individuals, and they achieved perfection because they kept the Noahide laws and they related to God. They were on a very high level because that's perfection, and they had no mediator. We don't hold that a person can't achieve perfection without a mediator. So the role of Moses, as I said, is to raise us to a higher level by virtue of the fact that he can achieve knowledge of how to relate to God that we can't, and he's our teacher. The other thing is that we see in the role of prayer, but that's not limited only to Moses. That is not limited only to Moses. That concept, the prayer of the community, the idea of the community is very significant. For example, we always say it's preferable or obligated to pray three times a day. One can pray by himself, but we have this idea, I'm sure you've heard the term minyan, which is 10 Jews, which represents the community of Israel. community prayer is significant. And we, as I mentioned last week, people will call in to ask if we can pray for them. The idea of one person praying for another person is an integral element of Judaism and does not have anything to do with mediating. We're not mediating for the other person. We're not saying you can't pray to God. But we do hold that God answers prayer, and it could be that this group or this individual merits to have his prayers answered, and if he prays for that particular individual, then it could help that individual. I'm going to just stop here and see what your reaction is. You know, I don't want to go on.
Okay. All right. Is anybody else?
I don't want you to accuse me of repeating myself.
Excuse me?
I don't want you to accuse me of repeating myself.
Okay. All right. Martina's over here. This is Miss Martina. Ah! I got hung the phone up. This is Miss Martina Buchanan, and I'm throwing the phone around and everything else. I think it's a...
Might you be related to Gary Buchanan?
That's his better half, and I think this is conspiracy or something going on with the phone.
His helpmate opposite him, I guess. Okay.
Okay, one of the questions I've got is what you brought up about the manna. You said that the manna that they ate was for the taste that, you know, what they desired, and that was what the murmuring was about. My question was about was you said that they did not defecate.
Yes.
Okay, what I wanted to know, God created animal and man and set forth the law of each nature of, you know, you
natural
law. Okay. If they did not defecate for the 40 years, how did their body go back and work properly afterwards? And then let's go back to Noah. When Noah was on the ark, did the animals defecate?
Which one? Let's deal with the, as far as the manna is concerned, the idea behind that is that this was a special food. This was a miraculous phenomenon. Due to the unique situation of the stay in the wilderness, this was a transitional phase. They had just, you know, been liberated as slaves from Egypt, and they had just received the Torah, and they were establishing the new entity of the people of Israel. And at that point in time, God did provide them with the basics. And this food was not part of nature; it was a miraculous thing which was provided by God for them. And yes. It was so perfected that it did not have the requirement that they would defecate. And of course, once they came into the land, it ceased. And then the normal functions of the body. I'm sure I don't want to get into all the specifics over here, but it doesn't mention anything about urinating. So they did drink, and I'm sure that process continued. And obviously, it didn't do any harm to them physically. So that when they made the transition, once they entered the land of Israel, the manna ceased. And then, from that point on, they came under the obligation. They came under the obligation of having to provide for their own sustenance, because now they had a land. And now they had the opportunity to study the laws, and their obligation was to establish a system, a society, in which they could function to provide all their necessities in a natural kind of a way, and at the same time to be involved in fulfilling the objective of a society which was in line with the laws of God. As far as the ark is concerned, I'm not aware of anything that indicates that this did not take place. The processes in that situation, they had to live in line with the normal processes. It wasn't 40 years. It was a shorter period of time. And as far as I know, they would eat the animals and the people would eat the normal food, and they would defecate, and they would have to do whatever is necessary in that situation. Okay? That's the answer to that question.
All right, Rabbi?
Yeah.
All right, here we are. This is James Long.
Okay.
And he is our Midrashic scholar.
Oh, boy.
All right. Oh, boy.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
Could you explain slander a little bit better? Give some examples. I know that you said that even if we're saying the truth about someone and it's bad, that we shouldn't do that. That's considered slander.
Yeah.
But I read in the commentaries, the Jewish commentaries, in the Talmud, the Midrashis, whatever, and they really don't care to say bad about people. And I just want to know what the difference is between what they're saying in the commentaries and if we say something bad about somebody, what the difference is, and if you could explain that better.
Before you get off, hello? I didn't catch the last part. I'm not sure I understand your question over here.
You should explain the last part.
Fine, but then you had another point? Speaking good, speaking bad about people, speaking good about people.
Speaking bad about people. Like I said, you know, in the commentaries, Esau comes to mind, where they go out of their way to tell you how many bad things Esau did to make Jacob look that much better. And to me, going on what you said about slander, to me that looks like that would be slander.
Oh, I got your question.
So if you could just show me a simpler explanation to what slander is.
Right. The sin of slander is a very serious sin, as I mentioned, and it means in an ordinary situation where basically a person is doing it for evil intentions. His desire is to destroy the reputation of another individual. His desire is to bolster his own image. The reason why I mentioned, even if an individual is mentioning something which is true, but the facts that he may mention are true, but still that would be considered to be slanderous, because what he's doing is he's trying to defame another individual. And as I pointed out last week, if you understand that on a deeper level, it need not necessarily be a human being that you're harming, because the spies are criticized for speaking badly about the land. And what does a land care? I mean, a land is not harmed by the fact that you speak badly about it. Now, the defect behind this, the evil behind this, is that it destroys your own soul. Because, as the rabbis pointed out, the motivating factor, what motivates an individual to slander somebody else, is the fact that he's hiding from himself his own defects. He's projecting his own defects onto somebody else. And by doing so, it prevents him from seeing his own weaknesses, his own shortcomings. Now, quite aside, of course, there's also practical. He's harming another individual. To verbally... You see, by the way, from the story we just did, that the sin that they committed was verbalization. And the human perfection... Man, the most difficult area to control, and I'm sure everybody will probably acknowledge this, one of the most difficult things to control, is the tendency towards gossip and slander. The entire society is permeated with this kind of thing. The newspaper gossip columns, people have a tremendous desire.
Really?
Yes.
Just let me give an example, and we'll nail it down more specifically. All right, suppose Jim Long here was about to go into business with another man, and I knew, because I had been in business with this man, that this man was not trustworthy. All right? Okay, so do I permit Jim being my friend, or even if I don't know him, but specifically if he's my friend, do I not tell him, hey, you better not go in business with this guy because I was in business with him and he beat me out of X number of dollars and I just walked off and left it?
That's a very good point. Thank you for the clarification. In that situation, you're obligated, if the case you mentioned, if someone's planning to go into business with somebody else, and you know that this person is a thief, you're obligated to make that information available to the other person. As a matter of fact, the entire system of testimony, when we have the Sanhedrin, when we have a functioning Jewish court, and we have 613 commandments, and as you know, many of these laws that we have are punishable by the court. A violation of the Sabbath, and eating forbidden food, engaging in adulterous relationships, and so on and so forth. A multitudinous amount of things. When a person sees another individual engaged in these types of behaviors, he's obligated to go to the Beis Din, to the Jewish court, and to testify against them. Well, when he's testifying against another individual, isn't that slander? He's destroying his reputation. The answer is, in that context, he's doing it not because he wants to destroy or defame somebody else, but not because he has certain emotions in which he wants to project onto somebody else. The context is extremely significant. Definitely, if this case arises, you know, arises in many situations for rabbis and, you know, for any individual who's involved in dealing with other people's problems, marriages, for example. You know, you get phone calls all the time about somebody may be interested, you know, a girl may be going out with a fellow from our yeshiva, and they want a character reference. You know, hopefully, most of the time I can give a good character reference, but if you know a specific problem, this person's been divorced, let's say, and you know that there are certain serious problems, well, let's say, for example, you know somebody, maybe it's not a person from the yeshiva, but I've known people that have been divorced, and they had drug problems, serious drug problems. And now they've hidden this from the other, from the girl, the prospective girl, you know, that they're going out with right now. These are very serious issues. I'm not going to set down the criteria, you know, when you withhold the information, when you give the information. But the case that you mentioned, Mr. Davis mentioned, was certainly that you have an obligation to protect your fellow man from being involved in a certain harm. If you know that somebody's a thief and he's going to steal from him or destroy his business or harm him in any way, then that is not considered to be slanderous talk. And I believe this enables me to answer the question, because when the Torah is pointing out, when the Torah is pointing out the defects of the wicked, it's doing so for an instructional purpose, so that we can learn. And that is not the purpose over there. If you study these cases seriously, it's not going to gratify your emotion of gossip, which as you read in the newspapers, you read the Inquirer, whatever it may be, you listen to these talk shows. So that's an emotional type of an involvement. You're thrilled about learning about somebody else's affairs or somebody else's downfalls and so on and so forth. That's an emotional thing, which is catering to all the wrong emotions. But when you study the Torah, it's all abstract. It's all ideas. And it's very vital for us to know these things. So that's a totally different situation. There the intent is not to engage in defamation of somebody else's character, you know, for any type of an emotional, to make us feel better. It's rather to study very carefully the ways of the wicked, and to recognize that we all partake of these emotions, and that if we don't deal with these emotions within ourselves and correct ourselves, then we should identify to a certain extent. We should realize that the wicked person is not a different creation. It's not somebody that's totally different. We partake of the same emotions, and if we don't use our intelligence and then discipline ourselves and look correctly, then we could wind up in the same situation. So that is not a situation of slander. All right, I'll stop at this point with that answer.
All right, okay. Did you hear that? All right, Heath, you got one?
No.
Oh, all right. Heath had his hand up. Anyone else? All right, Gary wants to talk about slander again. He's on a roll tonight.
Okay.
All right. Well, from what I understand of this, that we can safely say that if you're discussing an issue, that you're not belittling an individual for the sake of belittling them, but if you are obligated to reveal what you know if a person is to be harmed by another individual.
That is not slander. Very well put.
All right.
Slander.
Okay, thank you.
See, that's the difference.
This subject appears to be quite a fine line in some areas to me, and one of the key issues would appear that the intent of what you intend to achieve is a big issue. Let me give you a little more complicated situation. Let us say that I happen to believe that our president is doing a very poor job running our country, and say that I become very zealous in telling our people that in our country that I feel like our president is wasting our money and doing a poor job running our country, and that we're all going to be at danger, and that he's doing an injustice to all of us. Am I slandering him, or am I trying to help my fellow man?
Yes, absolutely. That would be a good example of a case where you not only are not, first of all, that shouldn't even be an issue of slander, because the president or any other public official would acknowledge that, at least openly, but I don't know what he believes inwardly, but is saying that the people should judge him and should vote him on the basis of the merits, and he's obligated to put forth his positions. And in a democracy, we have a right to challenge his positions. The truth of the matter is, first of all, that shouldn't even be an issue of slander, because to criticize a person's policies or his ideas and actions is not necessarily slander. You're just saying you disagree with those policies, and you point out you can analyze why these policies are hurting the nation. I don't even think that would be even an issue of slander. Slander would be when there's a certain defamation about the individual. I mean, you could make it, in other words, if you're discussing Clinton's economic policies and you don't agree with him, or his attitude towards issues like civil rights, quotas, and so on, and so health care reform, whatever it may be, that's not even an issue. If he objects, if he takes offense because people don't agree with his policies, then that's not slander. That's his problem. That means that his ego is totally tied up with his ideas. And
let me, if I could, cut in just for a minute.
Sure,
I was speaking, and I understand what you're saying, but let's say I attacked at his character.
And his character?
Yeah, let us say that maybe he said that he stood for an issue,
and then
he totally changed, and maybe I say, well, he's a liar, or maybe I say that he is stealing from me, or that he's a thief. Then I've attacked him in a different way.
Well, once again, let me just get it clear. You have information. If you're talking where you have specific information, I mean, to just call a person a liar without substantiation, I would say that's wrong. I would say that you're slandering the individual. You're attacking the personality of the individual, and it's totally unjustified.
All right, but I'll come in and clarify.
I'm sorry?
I'll clarify just for a bit, too. Like Gary, for instance, he's talking about the president. Bill Clinton ran on a platform that he would not raise taxes on the middle class. All right. In turn, he has turned around and he is raising taxes on the middle class and everyone else. Now, if I say that Bill Clinton is not reliable and he's not trustworthy, you'd say, well, how can you make that statement? I can say in his running for public office, he said, and his platform is that he would not raise taxes on the middle class. And he has. Therefore, he has lied and he has compromised his integrity.
Okay, good. Thanks for the clarification again. I would say that does not consider slander. Because you have a right. This is all public. First of all, everything you're talking about over here is public information. And you have a right to make these conclusions, these evaluations. All you're saying is that in his dealings as a politician in public life, he shifts with the winds. He makes promises and he doesn't feel obligated to keep them. That's part of the record. And the analysis of why he's doing it, whether it is irrelevant. I mean, whether the man has a character flaw or whether that's his concept of politics, whatever the case may be, you have a right to say that we can't trust him. We can't trust him because we see that he's made promises before, and when it's politically feasible, he goes back on them. That is absolutely not slander. And of course, again, you're not doing it because your objective is to destroy the man. Your objective is to make clear what's necessary for the country. It's for a purpose. The important in slander, in the issue of slander, motivation is a very, very important thing. If your motivation over here is not to destroy a man. I assume you don't have a personal vendetta, personal hatred for Clinton. But you have to clarify what's best for the nation. And everything you're talking about is purely, it's all out there in the public record. And this is a legitimate political conclusion. So I don't see any problem with slander over here. There could be areas. I mean, if you have personal information about the man, things that he did, and things that might be better or should remain private. I mean, questions could arise, but as you've expressed it so far, there would be absolutely no slander whatsoever. This is legitimate public, political discourse.
Okay. All right, if we don't have any other questions, we'll wrap it up. We've got about 15 left, but we can cut it short. And
what do you want? It's up to you.
All right. Has anybody got any more comments? And I think that kind of concluded in that area. All right, and we appreciate you coming back with us this week. And Rabbi Chait said he got him out of town 1 week and lose his job.
Not so easy, not so fair.
Right, right. Okay, we appreciate it very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right, thank you. Good night.